tell you what, it's a good choice. Hopefully our guest likes that walk-up, talk-up music. Because he, on the field, he was bad to the bone. And in 1989, his defensive end for the Vikings, Chris Dolman, Hall of Famer, got 21 sacks. But Chris Dolman was not the NFL Defensive Player of the Year. It was our guest, Keith Millard, 18 sacks. Without him, no way Dolman gets 21. Keith, I really appreciate you joining us. I loved watching you play.
Thanks for having me, Bob. I appreciate that.
It was fun. Not only that year in 89, but the whole time you were there. I covered the team for the Star Tribune at the time before I became a columnist. It's the most fun that I had being around the Vikings because you guys had character and you had a lot of characters on that team in addition to the character of the team. And you were probably the biggest character of all.
Why that?
Because you were fun. Well, but let's put it this way. There were days you were fun, and there were days I'd say, well, and you probably don't remember this, but there was a day you were walking through the early on, like your first year, you're walking to your car, and this is back in the days when you're carrying the projectors.
Right.
I said, Keith, you got a minute? You said, get away from me, I'll kill you. And I didn't argue. We'll wait another day. And we did. And Keith, I love dealing with you because you were always accommodating, other than that one time. But you're always great to talk to because you never shied away from the media. It was fun dealing with you.
Well, you're a hard guy to get away from, Bob. Trust me. I tried.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was elusive for you. Or you were elusive. You were elusive at times, but honest to God, Keith, it was great covering you. And I know that you've done coaching. Now you basically have a coaching academy that you're running, right, for defensive linemen.
Yeah, I've been doing it for probably, actually, I did it between NFL jobs. So if I was on a down year, I was out for a year. I'd always get requests from high school coaches or parents from my neighborhood or, combine places that would want me to work with the guys getting ready for the combine. So, just trying to stay busy, I kind of started doing it a little bit. And it's happening again. I'm out this year. As soon as I got home, the phone started ringing. So I started working with some combine kids. I've got a couple kids that I've worked with in high school that are now in college that I continue to work with. And I just kind of do it on the side just for fun, just to kind of stay busy. But really enjoy working with the younger generation that are hungry to learn and get better.
Now, Keith, when you meet these kids, have their parents told them about you and the type of player you were in the NFL? Or do they come in saying, that's some guy that used to play?
No, honestly, if I go through a high school coach, like if a high school coach contacts me, somebody that I've worked with before, or I know a lot of the high school coaches around in my old neighborhood, I'm sure they mention that I played in the league and that I've coached in the league. And then of course with social media, now you can just Google or Facebook, whatever you want to do. And they can find the rest by themselves. Sometimes that can be scary, but for the most part, it's been pretty positive.
Well, I took a look that year that you were the NFL Defensive Player of the Year, of course, and we're talking to Keith Millard. Dolman had the most. He had 21, I think. Who's the guy from Green Bay? Tim Harris had 19 and a half. You were at 18, but underneath you, you had Bruce Smith was under you. Swilling was under you. You had Lawrence Taylor was under you. I mean, you had years where these guys weren't touching. And I still believe no defensive tackle has had more sacks than you did in that year. 18 sacks for a defensive tackle is off the charts, not then and now.
Right. It was a good year. We were on a roll. The whole defensive line was on a roll. I mean, we played together. That was probably our fourth year together. We gelled together and we had a great D-line coach, Paul Wigan and then Floyd Peters. I mean, they put us in that position and said, go get them. And that's exactly what we did. And we were very competitive about it. We used to talk a lot of crap to each other about it. Chris used to tell me all the time that same year, because I was ahead of him by probably 6 or 7 earlier in the year, and he'd always tell me there's no way a white guy's ever going to lead the league in sacks. And it took him to the last game for him to pass me up. He had 4 against Anthony Munoz in the Cincinnati game. That's the game he passed me up. And actually, Tim Harris passed me up that same week. It was the last week. But those last 2 weeks that we played, I was hurt. I had a broken shoulder. So I don't think I had any sacks the last two games that we played.
Oh, so you didn't even but you did play that year, right?
I played, but I had a broken shoulder. I broke it in the Chicago game, early in the Chicago game, on a trap block by Keith Van Horst on the goal line.
Well, you know what? You're right, because you played all 16, started all 16. Yeah. So you were still drawing the double teams, which made it easier for him. It's your fault he got to 21, because you were stealing all those double teams.
I remember the conversation, because we were trying to get in the playoffs, and it was, you know, nip and tuck. And they said, if you can go so we can still continue to, you know, draw those double teams so we can at least get Chris in a one-on-one with Anthony, because obviously he was the best tackle in the league along with Gary Zimmerman in those days. That was a big order to fill. So I played basically just to keep things going the way they were, so at least we had a chance to beat Cincinnati, which we did the last game of the season.
Well, it was, and I've talked to all three of the guys I'm going to mention here, and now you would be the fourth one to ask you the same question. Randall McDaniel talked about it, Zimmerman did, and so did Dolman, all three of them in the Hall of Fame. And frankly, Keith, I mean, when I saw you play, you were a Hall of Fame caliber player, and I'm not just stroking you because you're on. I always felt that way, and I've always said it. But they all three talked about the fact that every day you were going against Randall, and he was going against Dolman against Zimmerman. You couldn't find two better tandems at tackling guard or tackling defensive end than, you know, those two sets. You and Chris against Randall and Zim, making each other better every day.
Yeah, there's no question about that. People ask me all the time, you know, who is the best guy that you ever played against? And Randall McDaniel is always the guy that comes up. I mean, always. And I remember saying, and I'll tell you this, and I've told him this, I hated going against him in practice because any other guards that I was ever worried about, but he was the one that was always hardest to beat. And going against him in practice, the odds were always against me because he was so good with his hands. He was so athletic. I didn't like going against him in practice because I didn't want him to ruin my confidence. So I skipped every other one or two just to stay on top of my game. I mean, he was that kind of guy. He could literally make you question yourself what you're doing wrong because he was so hard to beat.
Now, when you left here and he left here, he went to Tampa Bay for a year or two. Did you ever face off did you ever face him in a game?
Never. I mean, I went against him every day in practice. When I'm talking about Randall McDaniel, I'm talking about this is his rookie year out of Arizona State.
That's right. 88 was his rookie year, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And he nobody could beat him. I mean, I had a hard time with him practice. I got him every once in a while, but he won more of those battles than I did.
Well, that's, I mean, obviously it's a testament to how good he was and you also. Now, Keith, if an opportunity came in the NFL again, would you want to go back in the NFL or have you, you know, is it enough?
I don't know. You know, it's a great business. I love coaching. I love working with the players. I love working with the coaches. And it's still such a great game to me. The game has changed so much now, though. It's not like when I came up as a player or when I first got into coaching in 2001, when guys like Bill Walsh, Bill Parcells, you know, Mike Shanahan, that's the guy that hired me, you know, Greg Blosch. A lot of the old timers that were coaching when I played were still coaching when I got into coaching. It's changed a lot. It's not the same game. The old school element's out of it. It's becoming a lot more white collar. It's just a little different now. Yeah, I still love it. I'd probably still do it if the right opportunity came along, because I love it so much. The biggest thing for me is working with the players. I love doing that on a day-to-day basis and just being in the room with the coaches, strategizing, you know, getting ready for games. I love all that, but there's so much politics involved now, and there's just so much hoopla in the game now. I just think it takes away from the beauty of the game, which is the game itself and the players. I think there's just too much focus on coaches. There's too much focus on who's getting the next head job, who's going to be the next coordinator. I mean, you read more about that and hear more about that than you do the great players in our league. I just think, I don't know. When I played, we had great coaches, But you never heard about those coaches. It was always about the players. And to me, it should still be like that. And I think it's just, I think there's just way too many private agendas, guys trying to make too many, you know, leeway, trying to open up doors for themselves through the media instead of the blue-collar way of working for it and earning your stripes the right way.
We're talking to Keith Millard, Vikings. Well, I put you in the Vikings legend category, Keith, because you were, I mean, when you played, there was no one who had a motor there. You know who's come closest to you in the time I've covered this team? And I don't know if you've ever run into him. You and Jared Allen would be buddies. Because his motor was just like yours, and he would get animated after games, and you know he always was there if you needed to talk to him, and he reminded me of you. I know obviously he played at DE, but you guys weren't that far off in height either, because he was 6'6", and you were 6'6", too, right?
Yeah, well, I was 6'5". Right. I know some programs listen to me that tall, but I was never that tall.
But you were very similar in your in the way you approached the game. And have you ever talked to him or met Jared?
I never have. I remember when I was coaching, when he came out scouting him and looking at him when he was at Idaho. I remember working him out. I remember all that stuff. And the thing that really struck me with him in talking to him as a coach was his passion for the game. He was really hungry to be great. And exceeded my expectations. I mean, he's really worked hard to get where he is, and really, to be honest, made it look pretty easy. I mean, he's had a great career.
He has, but he also, the great thing from a media standpoint, he was always a go-to guy. He was always, no matter what the situation, he would answer the questions because he knew that was part of his responsibility, and much like you handled it too. Now, I know we talked earlier, you have six kids, and I noticed you wish your son Jack a happy birthday. He's at Western State College. He must be a football player too, because that young man looks put together.
Yeah, he's on a football scholarship. It's a D2 school in Colorado. He was a redshirt freshman last year. He'll be a redshirt freshman this year. He's doing great. It's a great academic school. He's a good student. He works hard at his craft, and we're really proud of him.
Is he a D lineman like you, or DT?
He's an outside linebacker, 3-4 outside linebacker.
And what kind of heights he got?
He's about 6'2", 6'3". All my kids, I don't know if you remember my first Dustin, he's like 27 now. He ended up being a little over 6'3". Johnny, my second one, who had a shot with the Rams last year, he's about 6'2". But I have a son that's just turned 16, Keith Jr. He's already 6'7". So most
Oh, my gosh.
My kids, yeah, it's really weird. Most of my kids are right around 6'3", 6'4", 6'2" range at full grown. And Jack's still grown. He's 6'2" right now. He's still grown. He's only 19 today. But Keith is a freak, man. He's already 6'7".
Where's he playing?
He's playing in high school.
No, I mean, is he a D lineman, or where do they put him?
He is a D lineman. His future could be O-line, but right now the only position he's playing is D line.
That's one boy. That's a name we're going to be hearing coming up in a few years. Keith Millard Jr. at 6'7". Oh my.
Yeah, he's a freak.
Okay, does he have half the motor you did?
He's a little bit more like his mother. I was pretty extreme. I don't know if any of my kids were that extreme. Thank God, but they all love the game and they all work very hard at it.
Well, Keith, I got to tell you, I'm glad because the reason I called you, we're both on Twitter and we hooked up through Twitter, and I'm glad we talked. I'd love to call on you again. This is it's a lot of fun talking to you, and I know people in Minnesota love hearing from you too.
I appreciate that, Bob. Anytime.
All right, Keith, take care. Keith Millard, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with our segment, our D-bag of the day segment, coming right up. And thank you again to Keith Millard, Vikings legend. He was, as I said, the fiercest pass rusher I've ever covered. We will be right back. We'll talk to you in a minute. And before we get into it, the Jim Rome line was pretty good about the biggest thing there'll be Mel Kiper at the draft. So, all right, Winston's not going. Marcus Mariota's not going. Our own Max Williams is not going. I actually reached out to Max earlier, and he had said that he can't do it today. He'd love to do it anytime next week, so we'll get him on next week to talk to him about, you know, why he's not going, but also just how things are going leading into the draft and what he's hearing from his agent and from teams. He's going to be a hell of a – whoever takes him is going to get one hell of a player.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. But, yeah, it was bound to happen where some of these guys just – why? If you're a player being drafted, yeah, you get to be in New York, but what do you can bring? They give you a couple of passes for your family or friends. Why not go stay at home where you can have all your college buddies with you, your entire family with you? I don't think it's it probably would be more fun.
Far less stressful wondering when you're going to get picked when you just sit there and wait for a phone call.
Yeah, you're not looking around saying, oh, my God, I'm still here. My God, nobody's taking me.
And I think these kids are starting to realize you can't put too much stock into the projections that you see from somebody like Mel Kiper.
No.
Because you could easily slip down into the 20s and
look at Teddy
Bridgewater.
Sitting
at your table over candlelight just waiting.
Well, and remember Johnny Manziel at the table.
Yeah.
Oh, he was nervous as heck. So, yeah, you just cannot... I think I think what they're doing is, as in the weeks now leading up to the draft, more are going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to say, the hell with it. Why should I go? There's really, unless you're the first overall pick, it's anticlimactic anyway. And the first overall pick isn't going.
Yeah.
Winston doesn't want to go.
He's got to go get some crab legs.
You know, they probably would have crab legs back there, though. They'd probably give him a pretty good deal, you know, that... back in that green room or whatever what do they call it? I've covered the draft in New York, and I don't know what they call it. The draft room, I guess, is what they would call it. But it's like
a green room.
It's like a green room when you're going out on one of the late shows, the late night shows. All right, we've got a few D-bag of the day candidates for you. This is one that you would think you would see in like a skit, a Saturday Night Live skit. Marvin Jones is a boxer, right? You know who he is, Marvin Jones. He had a match Friday night in Florida, and while boxing in the ring, do you know what happened to him? Do you see the story?
No.
His cell phone fell out of his boxing trunks. He had his cell phone in his boxing trunks. He claimed afterward that he'd been listening to music on his phone before the fight, tucked the phone in his shorts, then he headed to the ring, pulled out the headphones, but not the phone. He was caught up. You know, apparently it was... had one of the big phones, or maybe it was just stayed there. And then he's in the middle of the fight, and then he got beat too, by the way, I think, because he said that it threw him off. Man, my cell phone just fell out of the ring and on TV. It threw him off.
He probably tried to answer it and got punched in the side of the head.
That's when he bent down to pick it up to get the phone.
Oh, timeout. There's no timeouts in boxing like that.
He said for his for his next fight, he'll have someone pat him down.
Oh,
so, but
that's smart.
I would think I'd know if I was going in with the cell phone in your, you know, basically in your drawers there. Now, this one, we almost have to, you know, and we do break it down occasionally for different categories, because that one is just silliness and stupid. This one, Steve Bisciotti, the Ravens owner, he was at the epicenter of what started all the talk and, you know, making over the NFL for the way you are disciplined, particularly with domestic violence, because he owned the team that Ray Rice played for. Well, now he's going after the NFL, the policy that they're having, they're working on, and says it's, quote, pretty stupid that there's not a policy in place for domestic violence. First of all, and I'm not defending the NFL is not something I'm doing, except you want to get it right. You don't want to rush in and throw in a policy because they screwed it up before. They need to get the right. And it's an off season, so maybe they feel they have more time to do it, because it's certainly much more heightened, the attention on it, when you're actually in season.
Yeah.
Than in an off season. So I would hope and think that they would have something by then. But he said, I think we were pretty stupid in talking about as a league not to recognize domestic violence as a category by itself. No other infractions, failed drug tests, bar fights, or DUIs. Nothing to me should rise to that level. And he's right about that. And he said he was embarrassed that they were lumped together. And that, you know, pretty stupid that they don't have anything now. But, again, his handling of it. He said that he wished he had seen the video. And by the video, what he's talking about is, of course, the inside, the elevator video where Ray Rice just hauled back. He knocked out his then-fiancée, now-wife. She started walking toward him, and he just cold-cocked her. It was hideous. Except, and here's the except, I mean, when we saw the original video, of Ray Rice dragging her out of the elevator after he knocked her out, he just dropped her face down on the floor.
Yeah.
He didn't show any care for her, what condition she was in. That in itself should have been enough. This wasn't like she passed out and he was tenderly worried. He wasn't worried about her. That was clear from the video. He was not tending to someone who was any type of distress. He knocked her out, and he was just pulling her out. Then I remember he kicked her feet out of the elevator because they were, you know, still in the doorway.
Mm-hmm.
That should have been enough for them to, because originally wasn't it a 2-game penalty that he got?
Yeah, they gave him 2 games.
Yeah, and Bisciotti had to be involved in that. So he should have been harsh. There's a point, you can say it's pretty stupid, it's not enforced, but you own the team. You could do whatever you want, and then you deal with, if there's consequences or you get sued, do the thing that's right.
How about it's pretty stupid that they have to put something in there for that? Because it's already against the law.
Yes.
So why do they have to be reminded twice and punished twice for things? If it's against the law, you should just know that and not do it.
Well, this one, but for him to say, there's a guy that should really just be quiet on it. To say it's pretty stupid that there's no policy in place. You were involved in this. The reason there's a need for a policy stemmed and started with Ray Rice. Who, by the way, he's never going to play in the NFL again.
I wouldn't rule
it
out.
You really think so?
I
don't think so.
I knew nobody would sign
him
this offseason for sure.
Well, did you think? There was no chance he was getting signed last year. I don't think anyone's going to touch it.
Yeah, they're staying away from it for now.
Because here's what happens. You pick any team. Pick a city where he could be signed. Doesn't matter if it's
Cleveland.
All right,
Cleveland or Oakland.
All right, either one. In the Bay Area, every TV station in town will be playing that video over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the night that he would be picked up. And around the country. And the heat that they would take would be... unless Oakland might be the only one that could... weather, because they don't care what anyone does. They're like in a world of their own. Even without Al Davis, they're still the closest thing to a world of their own. They don't care really what anyone says or thinks.
Yeah.
Never have. But even that, though, would be a tough one, the weather. Because you would hope that in that organization there would be people who would say, you can't do this.
Well, there are guys like us, sports talk radio guys, that would completely blow this up and say, what are they thinking? I mean, I know we're the Raiders, but come on.
We'd say it too.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly, you're the Raiders, but what would you be thinking? I just think that it would be the heat you'd take. I'll go back to Mossy Cade mean anything to you?
No.
Well, Mossy Cade had been with the Packers, and he had been arrested for sexual assault. All right, and you know, went through whatever the process was at the time, and Mike Lynn of the Vikings picked him up. He lasted with the Vikings less than 12 hours. I remember going in to interview Lynn and saying, "What were you?" And that's the question: what were you thinking? And his question was, "What's the word out on the street?" I said, "The word is you're out of your mind." And I was in there with I was at the Star Tribune at the time. And I was out. I was also there with Kurt Brown, who was at the Pioneer Press. Where he was convicted in 87 of 2 counts of second-degree sexual assault on a woman he was related to through marriage. He was acquitted of a 3rd count, served 15 months in jail. So this would have been after that. You know, I believe it was afterward that he was he did wind up signing him. Yeah, he was upon release. He was signed by the Vikings, quickly released over the outcry. And that's what it was. Mike Lynn's question, what's the word on the street? And that's when I explained to him what the word was, because he never left his office. He didn't know. I will give credit to Lynn for this. He recognized then how bad it was to do this. He should have ahead of time. But that's even more of an embarrassment to this franchise and its history than the Herschel Walker thing. But at least to Mike Lynn's credit, he was gone. He rid himself of Mossy Cade by the end of the day. Picked him up and got rid of him.
Well, that's good.
Well, it was good. But, I mean, it's just to ever even have to go through that. Now, anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, we will talk to our guy in Vegas, Jim Suhan from the Star Tribune and SuhanUnfiltered.com. We'll see what's good. Jim's, I go to Vegas and I don't gamble, but they have some great food there. So I'm curious where he ate, what kind of chow he's putting down, and has he bet yet on the Final Four? He said he's not a big bettor, but it sounded like he was going to put a bet in. We'll talk to Jim about that, talk to him about the Wild. We got plenty to talk to him about. We'll be right back. Joined by Jim Suhan from the Star Tribune and SuhanUnfiltered.com, where you can check out Jim's podcast. Jim, I saw what you had put on Twitter, and it is, now you and I both grew up when there was smoking allowed in bars everywhere and restaurants, and now you can't, and around here you can't. But in Vegas, it's jarring to your system because everybody's smoking in those bars and in the casinos.
Oh, I'm amazed at how good the ventilation systems are because the smoke does get pulled straight up and out someplace. But I'm just hypersensitive. My parents were chain smokers, and I've never liked it. So it still bugs me, even though it's amazing the technology they've built in these buildings. Because people can be smoking 5 feet away from you, and somehow the smoke disappears up into the vents, and it doesn't really get to you too much.
Yeah, but it does, because it was very noticeable. Because every time I go to Vegas, and it's, you know, once a year I've been going, it's a reminder. Oh yeah, they can smoke here.
Oh yeah, they're not going to discourage people with obsessive compulsive bad decision making to come to Vegas, so they're going to let them smoke.
No. Now tonight we find out what happens with. Okay, I'm going to make a really bad transition. If the Wild are still smoking hot with a four-day layoff, going against a team that conceivably could be in the Stanley Cup Finals, the Rangers, this layoff is going to be interesting to see how they respond from a four-day layoff, him and Dubnyk particularly.
Can we go back and have you not do that transition?
No.
It's too late, isn't it?
Maybe for the podcast we can take it out.
It's too late, yeah. I just think we talk about stuff like that because there's not much else to talk about. I mean, I don't think the layoff affects them all that much. I mean, they needed a rest at some point. They've been grinding for a long time. They've had a lot of back-to-backs. They've had a lot of tough games. There's another tough game. I think it's a good thing Dubnyk gets a few days off. This is the only way he's going to get a break unless they end up locked into a playoff position where they have played some meaningless games. So I think it's a good thing.
Well, I'm very curious because I am, and I'm looking forward to seeing how they do against the Rangers because that's probably the best team over on the other side. It looks like the way it's shaping up, though, they're going to wind up right now. It looks like Nashville, which is not a bad draw for them if they're the first wild card playing Nashville. Anaheim, of course, having the top seed in the West. That's a good matchup for them, I think.
I think it's the best possible matchup. We've talked about this before, Anaheim. Anaheim just always finds a way to beat them by one goal. It feels like guys who just know how to play playoff hockey. They give up some goals, though. So I don't think, I think the Wild would certainly have a pretty good fighting chance. It'll be a really interesting series. I think Nashville peaks about December. And they're very good defensively. They have an excellent defenseman. They have a defenseman who can score. They have an excellent goalie. But I think the Wild might win that one in 5 or 6.
Well, and then if they get past that one, it gets real interesting because I do think that this is a team that I think the expectation is much higher than it's been the way they've played the second half of the season. We'll see how far they go. Now, Jim, in covering baseball, have you ever talked to players about the jewelry they wear?
At times, yes. Well, and I always thought it was, I always thought it was bizarre that you would want to wear jewelry on the field, especially jewelry that could get tangled at some point. You know what I mean? You're sliding to second base. You don't want the second baseman's hand getting caught on your bracelet or your
necklace.
Your necklace.
Yeah.
I'm blanking on the word necklace. Sorry.
Well, the reason
I've always found it really bizarre.
Well, I bring it up because Irvin Santana is being sued by Major League Jewelers, Inc. out of Miami. They're saying he defaulted on $40,000 worth of customized gems. Well, on the attorney for Irvin Santana is claiming that it was fake. Now, what's interesting about it, this is a group that's been around 40 years and has given jewelry to Marlon Byrd, Hanley Ramirez sold it to, CeCe Sabathia, Dwayne Wade's gotten some, Paris Hilton's worn their jewelry. They've been around a while. I just find it fascinating that it's very easy to see if jewelry's fake or to know for sure. So to throw that around, it's interesting that people have this kind of disposable income to spend $40,000 on jewelry and not pay for it when you're making $55 million from a team.
Yeah, I would want to know more about this. It's always easy to jump on the athlete and say, okay,
I'm not ripping anybody here. Yeah. I'm just amazed by it.
Yeah, I mean, you and I can't relate to people who can spend $40,000 on jewelry just for the heck of it. I mean, it's always remarkable to see the play, and I see it even more when the players spent more time in the clubhouse during access period. I mean, you'd walk by a guy's locker and he'd be sitting there reading a Porsche magazine. You know what I mean? I mean, literally, he'd be picking out his Porsche from not a magazine, a catalog. He'd be picking out the features. I remember Brad Radke buying a Porsche that had every available option. This isn't exactly the flashiest guy you've ever been around. They end up with more money than they could have ever imagined. and they don't really necessarily think about the days when those salaries are going to stop. And they feel like it's free money. You know, they feel like it's Monopoly money. But, you know, I don't know if Irvin Santana did something wrong here or not. I will say that I have seen it many times. I saw it with Molitor once with some contractor early in his career where, you know, somebody called me when I was a beat writer and said, hey, Molitor didn't pay for this work being done. Well, it's an easy way to put leverage on a player to try to defame him publicly. I would let this one play out a little bit.
No, and I mentioned it just because of the numbers. I mean, 40 grand on jewelry. My God, it must be great to have that kind of dough
that's
on
not
hand.
That much. I mean,
no,
seen,
it's not.
Not for those guys. I mean, I've seen guys put on stud diamond earrings that probably are worth $100,000.
Yeah. And think about the kind of money, because there will be athletes going, and there will be certainly others. $87,000 for a ringside seat for the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, just for one of the seats.
Good Lord.
$87,000. Wow. And it could end in the first round.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, let's be honest, it's narcissism. You know, it's saying, hey, I have to be in the front row, and people have to see me. Because, you know, you and I spend a lot of time around crowds. The sports writers, you're always around crowds. And being around a crowd isn't necessarily all that much fun. At least maybe my old guy side, now that I've reached a certain age talking, but you know, you deal with crowds, and especially if you're a celebrity at a public event like that, you're going to get hassled. You really have to want the attention. So not only want to go, but you want to spend that kind of money.
Well, and you know, talked about this the other day. That number. Imagine the size screen you could buy. How many of them? It'd be like you could outfit one of those sports books we talked about the other day, with some of those big screen TVs to watch. Get that and have all your buddies over. You'd be a bigger hero with them if you had that kind of dough.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have the cameras on you.
No, and that's for a lot of people that seems to be an important thing. Now, Jim, have you gotten any closer to placing a bet on the games, the final four games?
I'm thinking about it. I try not to bet early in the week because I don't want to lose and feel like, and then get that bug where you feel like you need to kind of win it back. So I kind of wait till later in the week to place any bets. One of the podcast listeners asked me to place a bet for him. So I'm going to place a bet for him on the Twins. And when I'm doing that, I might go ahead and slide a small amount of money on a long shot.
What's the bet on the Twins he wants? Not to win the division.
500 or better.
Well, that's not. What are the odds on that? Do you know yet?
I haven't looked that up yet, but I would say that Vegas still has the Twins down in the mid 70s for victories. I don't think they're buying into any great changes. I think most Twins fans. Well, I don't know about most. I think a lot of Twins fans, including me, expect this to be a better year than it has, although not a great year. So if I were going to bet on the Twins, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't bet on the teams I cover. If I were going to bet on the Twins, I would bet 500 or better.
Well, I would actually just bringing in the bling guy, Santana, could help you get closer to that.
Right. Well, and the other thing is, the reason to think that they can be a 500 better team this year is to buy into the notion held by many people in the Twins front office, which is last year's team really underachieved in terms of wins and losses. When you look at how many runs they scored, and any just slight improvement in the rotation combined with continued development of guys like Vargas and Santana, they're probably going to score as many or more runs. The rotation has to be better. I'm not thrilled with the bullpen, but I also think that's a work in progress that could get fixed as the season goes on. And if your rotation pitches well, the bullpen, you don't need as many bodies as major league teams have to carry around these days. But I do think it's going to be better this year.
Well, I think you're right about that, too. And now, you're Jim Suhan from the Star Tribune, suhanunfiltered.com. Who is if they went to Suhan Unfiltered? What's the most recent one you have posted?
Rob Anthony and Terry Ryan just posted today, so those two are the latest two. Russo's going to do one from O'Gara's on Friday night.
Okay, tomorrow night
taking my place, and that'll be the Friday edition. And then McKavitz, Tom Kelly, Gene Glenn, Byron Buxton will all run sometime in the next week or two, probably.
That's a great baseball lineup. Well, Jim, enjoy the night, and we'll talk to you tomorrow from Vegas. Jim Suhan from the Star Tribune, and of course SuhanUnfiltered.com. We'll talk to you tomorrow, Jim. Thank you.
Thanks, bud.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, Rick Haro. Nobody knows the business of sports like Rick Haro. Looking forward to talking to him again. It's been a long time since we talked to him with all the Thursdays off we've had. Talk to Rick when we return.
Show me the money.
We are joined by Rick Haro, host of Bloomberg Sportfolio, tonight at 8:30. also host of Beyond the Medals, The Business of Sport, the third new episode of the third Wednesday of each month, and also Horrow, H-O-R-R-O-W, sports.com. Rick, it's like we haven't spoken in years.
We haven't spoken in a few days, months. You've been preempted.
Yes, we were preempted by
the NCAA tournament.
By the Big Ten tournament, the NCAA tournament. We had the state tournament of hockey in Minnesota is enormous here. So we played those games too. But it's great to hear your voice again. And we catch you on a day where we're heading into a pretty good sized weekend and a pretty big, to me, it's the best week in sports. Next week, Monday night, you get the Final Four, the championship game, you get baseball, and you get the Masters.
And for some people, the women's Final Four, which I reminded people is kind of important.
Excuse me? The two Final Fours.
Yeah. That's better. All right, that's a little better. So I'm heading to Indy, where the average price, by the way, for the good seats is about $17,000 for a pair because of the iconic matchup of four teams. And you could call it a toss-up. I guess Kentucky looks like the juggernaut, but maybe Notre Dame showed that they might be vulnerable. And at the end of the day, the ratings should be off the charts. And, if you wanted a good case of Adam Smith's invisible hand and you want to talk a little bit about the economy of business, then stand on the steps of Lucas Oil Stadium on Saturday night, where the winners get tickets bought for their family from the losers, and the losers slink out of town on Sunday morning. Because remember, you buy those two game day strips, and only a half of them want the second day. Nobody else wants to stay if their team has lost. So it is a massive commercial opportunity on Saturday night after the game.
You're saying $70,000 for a pair of tickets. That's for the semifinal. Oh, that's for the whole both strips. What will they sell for when they're resold by the losing teams? What kind of money do you think that'll bring, or what has it traditionally bring?
Yeah, closer to face, but normally it's $5,000 or $6,000 for a $10,000 ticket that would be if it is a winner. So it's big dollars. I mean, so somebody, I guess, who loses in the semis feels like they can recoup some of their investment by selling it to the people that need to stay around.
Now, Rick, you obviously you know the people involved in the organizing committees for all these big events. Is there concern about, and the state of Indiana is in the process of, they haven't already correcting it or making it, amending it, the so-called religious freedom law, is that going to affect them financially in any way?
Well, it depends on what happens fairly quickly. You know, everybody is there for the Final Four. I'm not sure that there are a lot of people who will have changed their plans, because the law wouldn't have taken effect until July anyway. And remember what happened with the immigration law in Arizona, where people were playing around with moving the mega event there. And clearly, Martin Luther King Day celebrations in Arizona years ago, which actually caused the Super Bowl to be moved out of town, and the Super Bowl that the Steelers and the Cowboys played years ago got played, but 2 years later there. So if it happens, it happens gradually. I think the economic development folks in Indiana are winning out, and they're saying you better change this.
Now, you also, because I mentioned baseball starts next week, you know all the commissioners. Rob Manfred, is he excited about a healthy year financially for baseball?
Well, more important than that, his owners are excited, and frankly, that's what it's all about. When you take a look at the numbers, $36 billion of total net worth from all of the teams combined, and the average franchise now is $1.2 billion. Which is a 48% increase over last year, which is unheard of. If I had an asset that appreciated 48% of any kind, I would love the guy that caused it to increase. And Bud Selig, with all of his detractors, did an amazing, masterful job for Major League Baseball. When he came in, the average annual revenue, about $1.5 billion, and when he left, it was about $9 billion. When you look at all of the business issues, but feel like it's to be commended.
What made the jump? That 48%. I'm sure it's not just one thing, but what was the biggest thing of the issues that went into it?
Well, the biggest thing is the local television deals, which continue to increase, and then the increase in the television deal with Fox and ESPN, and just like in basketball, and just like in football, and just like in hockey, the TV deals that continue to go up and up and up are the staple, because you can borrow against those revenues. You can do anything you want to with it. The bottom line is it causes the franchises to go through the roof and make them better to be sold. All of the owners who even have teams that are performing in a mediocre way right now want to hold on because the values continue to go up. And that makes them even more valuable.
Now, we're talking to Rick Haro, and Rick, because you're at every big event, but I need to ask, with you'll be at the Final Four, you'll be at the championship game, I'm guessing. Where do you go from there? Right to Augusta? Will you go to a baseball game? What's your week look like?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out if I can stop in Cincinnati on the way to the Masters, and right now I'm working out whether or not getting there on Wednesday means that I can go to a Reds game on the way out of Indy as well. But, oh, absolutely. I mean, what are you kidding? This is a week you can't miss.
No, and you're not going to miss the par three on Wednesday.
No, the Wednesday par three is a big deal.
Yeah.
They're going up to the first round of the Masters and then go back home and watch three rounds on television, which is the best experience of them all.
Boy, you have the life. Now, tell us, what will be the topic on Bloomberg's portfolio tonight?
Well, the
Final
portfolio,
Four?
And, yeah, Beyond the Medals is all about all of them kind of saying Final Four stuff, economic impact of it, the Masters in the business of golf. We're preparing a really good business of golf show for Beyond the Medals, not only the international stuff, but getting ready for the Olympics a year away, golf and the Olympics. And so it's a big fix like everything else, the mega events here.
Well, it's you must be having a lot of fun, particularly since you added Beyond the Medals to Bloomberg's portfolio.
Well, having a lot of fun also because my daughter is a Dookie. And I made the comment that, you know, if you're in the Final Four, we're going. She called me right after the Gonzaga game was over and reminded me of the promise. What are you going to tell a 21-year-old who absolutely remembers those kind of things? No?
No, you can't. No.
Yeah, can't.
No.
Right.
Well, that's going to be a great weekend for you to spend with your daughter. Rick, thanks so much for taking the time with us. We'll talk to you next week. Rick Haro.
See you next week.
8:30 tonight, Bloomberg's Portfolio. And on Wednesday nights, every third Wednesday, you can catch it a lot during the month. Beyond the Medals, the business of sports. I'm going to turn things over to superstar Mike Morris and Ben Holson. Stick with them until 7. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Thank you.
At the terror in each sip and in each sup. Will you partake of that last offered cup?